Hello, Brian Curtis.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I am doing well. My name is Con Carroll. I'm the editor of the Heritage Foundation's blog, The Foundry, and I'm here talking to Brian Curtis of The Daily Beast. And do you carry any other affiliations?
That's the one I'd like to carry today.
Okay, fair enough. We've got a pretty full slate today, kicking off with the tax cut deal, which was cut last night between the White House and congressional Republicans. Small rehash, just extenuation of the current Bush rates, throwing in as well the estate tax at a reduced 35% instead of 55% for only 2 years. And in return, the president gets 16 months of unemployment extension. He gets his making work pay stimulus tax credit converted into a 2-point payroll tax holiday for 1 year, along with some other tax items, including a year of no expensing for businesses. I think the final price tag is some $900 billion over 2 years.
That sounds right.
And I would say, judging so far, most conservatives are happy about it. I still think we could have gotten a better deal. But what do you think about it, Brian?
Well, I think, I mean, when you say the conservative reaction, I mean, I'd also like to note what the liberal reaction is, which is interesting, right? Because I think you have sort of two camps. You have the one that is disappointed with Obama for compromising, right? And compromising on terms that they see as not particularly favorable. And then you've got a kind of a second liberal camp that a week ago was so worried that they were going to get completely rolled on this deal, that they're just grateful that, you know, that they got a better deal than they perhaps thought they were a week ago. Is that about right?
Yeah. I mean, it's been interesting to watch. You know, I was tuning to MSNBC this morning, and you had Joe Scarborough, of all people, sticking up for the progressive view of the president should have driven a harder bargain. And then you had the new Democratic network types going on air to defend it. CAP also has a study out purporting to show that this plan will save or create, one of my favorite phrases, save or create 2.2 million jobs over the next 2 years. So I think, you know, you have kind of the more institutional rallying of the wagons, circling the wagons on the left.
Right.
And we'll see if the newer, you know, fire dog like Jane Hampshire, Huffington Post of the world will get online, or if they'll keep complaining about the deal.
Right. And I mean, they haven't been on board for a while, I think we can broadly say, with the Obama administration, right? So if they weren't to jump on board, that wouldn't be particularly surprising. I mean, I sort of think, when I look at this, it feels to me like the official beginning for the White House of the 2012 campaign, because on a couple of levels. I mean, the one thing is, you note, is that they basically just kicked the can 2 years down the road, right? We're going to have the same fight or some kind of similar climactic battle in 2 years, in right, you know, before or during the 2012 election, right?
Right.
So on the one sense, it's just going to be a campaign issue. On the second hand, I think, as Ezra Klein was noting in his thing today, it's geared less toward deficit reduction probably than just doing everything that the White House could get to try to pump up the economy over the next 2 years, right? So Obama's trying to, in at least through the way he thinks, to try to create a positive economic climate to run on in 2000, or at least a less negative one, right?
Oh yeah, I think you could definitely fairly call this stimulus two.
Stimulus two, right?
With the price tag, the sheer amount of money going into it, I think there's definitely a large segment of the White House that feel that this is their second bite at the stimulus apple.
So in that case, right, they're doing what they think would improve the economy so that they'd have a better record, a better hand to play in 2012. So that's the second way. And then I think the third way for the campaign is just, you know, symbolic, you know, sort of, I wouldn't say symbolically, because it's actually more than symbolically, but reaching out to Republicans and making a deal at a point where it looked, you know, even a week ago or even a couple of days ago, like you were going to be in this really intractable period of partisan wrangling, right, even in the lame duck session. And, you know, I think Obama and I think the White House is pretty sensitive to the fact that a lot of people think they weren't going to be able to make deals with Republicans. Obama, as we know, is very invested in the idea that he can make deals with Republicans and make deals with everybody on the Hill. And so I think just some kind of accord, and whether they lose on some points or whether they win on some points is very big, too, to set up, you know, the kind of narrative as he's going to play it in 2 years.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the New York Times headline today was, you know, tax deal shows new path for Obama. Doug Holtz Egan has a post on the corner saying, you know, that this deal is all about the 2012 election. I think that that's definitely what they're going for.
Yeah.
I think what's, you know, going into it, you know, why I think the Republicans could have helped for a better deal is just, you know, how much over barrel Republicans had the White House and the Democrats. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that senior administration officials are telling the press that their own economists had a return to the Clinton tax rates, no matter how temporary, causing a shock to the market that would have been worth 2 percentage points of growth and a full percentage point bump up in unemployment. So, I mean, if that's what your side believes is the outcome, if there's no deal, you're going to be pretty strongly motivated to make a deal. So
yeah.
I really don't see how much of any choice the Obama administration had here, or really how much they really wanted to raise. They didn't, you know, how much they wanted to raise taxes to begin with.
Yeah.
You know, even their own multipliers show that, you know, taking $700 billion out of the economy by raising taxes on the rich, even though it didn't, you know, according to their models, stop a lot of job creation, they're pretty hungry for all job creation they can get right now.
Mm-hmm. And so what, I mean, I guess my question to you is then, if the Republicans sort of have had the White House over a barrel so much, if they came in, you know, talking, whereas Mitch McConnell's saying, you know, our biggest goal is to defeat Obama 2 years from now, why make a deal? You know, why sort of roll over and do that so quickly?
Well, I think, you know, as much as the left likes to make the Republicans, especially the senators, Senate Republicans, be this, you know, phalanx of no, they are senators. They have egos. They like to make deals. Mm-hmm. And I think and actually, to be non-cynical for a second here, I do think that most of them think this is a good deal for the country. I think that most of them do feel that these tax cuts will help recovery, and that they think this is a good policy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not gonna outlaw or just cross out any notion of sincerity here.
Yeah, no, and I wouldn't either. I mean, I would also point to a post that Jonathan Chait has up at the Plank today, where he's saying that, you know, tax cuts, and especially, you know, the extension of the Bush tax cuts, play such a big role in the GOP sort of mind that once you agree to extend them, even for 2 years, that there's just a lot of deal making that can suddenly take place, right? I mean, just that concession on the part of Obama sort of opens his door, and I doubt Jonathan would ascribe, you know, the kind of motives you're ascribing to the GOP, saying best for the country, et cetera, but he would say that, you know, if we grant that they think that will help the economy, then once you grant that, they are actually much more ready to deal than maybe they've been portrayed.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, it was 1 week ago, 2 weeks ago, you had, you know, Paul Krugman and Steve Bannon and Matthew Glacis all talking about how, you know, the Republicans were purposely trying to sabotage the economy. You know, I think this pretty much puts the lie to that. I mean, I think at some point you have to take politicians' beliefs on face value. And you can disagree with Republicans for believing that tax cuts create jobs. But at some point, I think you have to see when they step up to the table like this that you know, they actually believe it, and this is them putting that belief into work.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the only argument I would have is that when you say that they've been portrayed as the phalanx of no, I mean, I sort of think they've portrayed themselves in a lot of cases as the phalanx of no and been proud of it, right? I mean, there was a lot of, you know, Mitch McConnell crowing before the last election that, you know, we did a great job of saying no. And, you know, when he came out and said right after the election, our biggest goal is to, you know, to deny Obama's second term, you know, where to make the jump from that to sabotaging the entire economy is a big jump. But to just take him, when we talk about taking him at face value, he is putting a lot of his own rhetoric into being, you know, Mr. No in the Senate, right?
Definitely. Definitely.
So
enough about the tax cuts. Now that that's over, there is still a rather large agenda that Harry Reid has left on his platter.
To say the least. And, and you know, I think the big thing for him and the first thing is the Dream Act, which, you know, he promised very dramatically right on the eve of his tough campaign against Sherrin Engel that he would at least put up for a Senate vote. And, you know, promised Latino leaders nationally and Latino voters in Nevada. It helped him to some degree get reelected, depending on which exit poll you look at. Either tremendously helped him, put him over the top, or certainly didn't hurt him. And now that has become, you know, his big issue in the Senate is putting forth this bill, and which would, in many cases, allow immigrants who came out to the United States illegally as minors with their parents become citizens or be put on the quote-unquote pathway to citizenship so long as they graduate from college or join the military. Am I characterizing that correctly?
Well, attend college for 2 years.
Right, attend college.
So, you know, you could sign up for the Barbizon School of Modeling for 2 years, and you're set.
Right. And let's not detract from the role that models play in our in our recovering economy here. We need them too.
Right. But you know, it's important. You don't have to graduate. You just have to attend.
So right. But put in what we would consider a good showing at a college.
So do you think this is going to pass?
You know, the people I've talked to who would be, I would say, on balance, certainly people who want it to pass, I have not gotten a notion from any of them. I haven't gotten a solid yes from any of them. I think it's still an uphill climb. Now,
can you name names without naming names? And what type of people are you talking about here?
Oh, you know, everybody from chiefs of staff on the Hill for very, very important congressmen, Democratic congressmen, to, you know, people in immigration interest groups who've met with the president of the White House in the last 6 months.
Because okay. this is definitely something where the Democrats have enough Republican votes to get to 60. Because you've got Bennett who says he's a yes. You've
right.
got Lugar, who's voted for it before. Same with Brownback. Same with the Maine sisters. And you got Voinovich, who's retiring, so who's imminently gettable, who just came out, against the Bush tax rates. So you have some Republicans in the pocket. You have a bunch that are gettable. So it's going to come down to the John Testers and the Webbs and the McCaskills. And whether or not the Democrats in the White House can close the deal with those Democrats.
I think that's right. And, you know, the one thing I'd say, though, is that for every Republican that's gettable, and I agree that there are not a large number that are theoretically gettable, there's also a large number of Democrats that are potentially will defect, right? You not only have, you know, people like Tester in Montana, who's got a very tough reelection here in 2 years. Max Baucus, I would say, almost certainly isn't going to vote for this. You know, you could have anywhere from 8 to 10 Democratic defections too, right? So I think you're right. Part of it's Harry Reid and part of it's the White House being able to convince their caucus all together and to come through on this. But I just think it's going to be a very, very. There's a little bit of a long shot to me, just because of the number of Republicans you have to convince. And you say there's a lot of Republicans that are gettable, but I would also just caution that, you know, some of those Republicans also face, you know, Tea Party primary challenges in 2 years, potentially, right? Kay Bailey Hutchison of Texas is thought as a possible yes vote for this. In fact, she's had Dream Act protesters camping outside her office for days and days. But,
right, and Hatch would be another one that was an original co-sponsor way back when in, like, 2003. And
right.
Of course,
yeah,
of course,
and has been a very solid voice in favor of different kinds of immigration reform. But he's another one potentially could have a primary challenge in Utah. He should ask Bennett about that, right?
Right. No, that's exactly what getting rid of Bennett was about. You know,
right.
There's a reason Bennett is no longer with us, and Hatch being a successful politician so far is going to pay attention to that signal.
And Maine, which we think of as a super centrist, you know, left or too left-leaning state, you know, the Republican Party there is very, very charged up, you know, depending on what you read, you know, about staging a big primary challenge in 2 years. So I think it's a very, very difficult road to climb. It's not impossible. I haven't had anybody that's in the pro-Dream Act camp tell me, you know, we're not going to get this done privately or publicly. but I don't believe they think they have the votes. And I also talk to Republicans on the Hill, too. I don't think they think the Democrats have the votes yet. Now, maybe that'll happen with the tax deal, right, because that was kind of the first thing that had to get off the table. Maybe then that shakes loose some people that were kind of holding out. Orrin Hatch in particular said he wasn't going to do anything until the tax deal was done. But I still think it's an uphill climb, and I think there's still a lot of tricky politics to navigate there.
There are. I mean, just to name a few, you have New Start, which if you had to go into the White House and ask Barack Obama what his priorities were, do you think New Start would be ahead or behind DREAM Act?
I think the DREAM Act is probably about as low as you can get on his current list of priorities without being at the absolute bottom.
Okay, well, we're in agreement there. So, yeah, you've got New Start, and we still have to fund the government. The government's only funded through the 18th of this month. That's fast approaching. So after the tax deal gets done, which isn't done yet, we have a deal, but we don't have any votes on it. Then you have to fund the government. Then you have to either do or do not do New Start. Mm-hmm. And that's, that's three items, and then maybe DREAM Act next.
Right. And, I think we'll talk about Latino leaders and their dissatisfaction in their relationship with Obama in just a second. But I think, if you look at how the president's treated immigration over the last 2 years, I believe it is something that, he is definitely intellectually in favor of the DREAM Act, intellectually in favor of what we call comprehensive immigration reform, a.k.a. a pathway to citizenship. But I think for, all 11 million or so illegal immigrants in the United States right now. But I don't believe it's something that he spends a whole lot of time worrying about. I was actually talking to Richard Land, who's at the Southern Baptist Convention, as and he was, telling me, he's for, by the way, comprehensive immigration reform and for the DREAM Act. Mm-hmm. And he told me, I think it's a preference for Obama, but I don't think it's a passion, or words to that effect. And I think that's about right. I think, when it comes to the president of immigration, he's not going to risk a ton of political capital to get anything done about it. And, the fact is we're talking about the DREAM Act, right? And this is not a particularly, this is in the grand, constellation of sky of immigration legislation, this is actually a really, really small component that helps a really fairly limited number of people.
Yeah, no, I think it's hard to look at his body of work as president so far, and you can't really point to anything that says immigration reform is a priority of this president.
Not at all. Not at all. And no, other than maybe like a White House spokesman, I've never had anybody defend Obama on that score.
So I think that leads us to an article you wrote, which I found fascinating, about Luis Gutierrez and the divorce between Latinos and the Democratic Party.
Yeah, thanks for saying that. I mean, I interviewed Luis Gutierrez, who's a congressman, Democratic congressman from Chicago, who's been the major driver, I think, in certainly in the House and probably in the entire Congress for immigration reform over the last several years, going way back into the Bush administration. And he has been among Latino politicians, I think, probably the one who has voiced more disappointment with Barack Obama than anybody. But I think there's a very, very widespread feeling among almost any Latino leader you talk to right now, a huge disappointment about the president. Just for some background, Barack Obama, when he was campaigning, made a very explicit promise to start the process of immigration reform within 1 year of becoming president. Now, that year expired for various reasons, not all of which had to do with the fact that Barack Obama didn't want it to get done. The year expired, and then nothing happened basically after the year expired until we got to this period now where you and I are talking about that the DREAM Act has sort of an outside chance of passing. So what Gutierrez, after all this sort of disappointment, all these months and years of kind of waiting and nothing happening, basically what he told me is that we're done for now playing politics. And we're done specifically with playing politics in the legislative process.
I read that, but what does that mean?
Well, what it means is, I think, what you have to remember is that Latinos have invested, especially over the last 3 years when Democrats control both houses of Congress and the presidency, have invested a lot of political capital in trying to get a bill, in trying to work with the president, one, right? Waiting for him to be ready, and two, trying to push a bill through the Senate, which means getting 60 votes to try to pass a cloture vote, right? And what Gutierrez is saying is, we're not going to do that anymore. We're just, as soon as the Dream Act little episode here ends, either positively or negatively, we're done playing by those rules. And what we're going to do is we're just going to start a massive campaign of protest and civil disobedience, and we're going to try to do try to accomplish all our goals through that, is basically what he said.
Okay, so what would that look like?
What it would look like, I think, is you've seen probably a preview of that over since late in the Bush administration, when there were lots of really massive protests in cities like Dallas and Los Angeles, where you have lots of very organized big marches. Gutierrez, by the way, has already gotten himself arrested in front of the White House, so he's I think proved his bona fides on this score. But massive protests, sit-ins of the kind that the Dream Act protesters are already doing in front of Senate offices. I think a big concern for the Latino community right now is the number of deportations that Barack Obama's done, which have actually been ramped up quite a bit since the Bush administration.
Well, the numbers have been ramped up. The Washington Post had a story out early this week, I don't know if you saw it, showing that the White House has actually been kind of playing with the reporting numbers while not actually ramping up deportations.
Right.
But it is interesting that they are trying to fudge the numbers to have that talking point. I mean, I think that's not nothing.
To have that talking point, and I think what Latino leaders would say was, you just, you know, to create an environment where you have a card to play to make a deal, you just need to sign an executive order and stop lots of deportations, right? I mean, it's one of the few things that Obama doesn't have to wait for the 60th vote in the Senate to do, which is what I'm borrowing rhetoric from the movement. This is what they've said.
Can I stop you right there? Because I think that's you close with that in your article, and I don't see that reported a lot. I've seen it reported, but mostly on what I think people on the left would consider fringe conservative outlets. Is that, could you talk about the mechanism by which President Obama could stop deportations?
He couldn't, I mean, it's what he could do, and what I think you saw President Bush do is you can certainly manipulate policy, and you can manipulate enforcement mechanisms so that you can either be aggressively deporting people from the United States, or you can withdraw from that and you can deport fewer people from the United States.
I think you're missing this. There's also a specific law that would empower Obama to just stop deporting people to Mexico.
Right. No, I agree. What I'm saying is I don't think Obama would specifically go that far, probably. But just to take one example, right, late in the Bush administration, when George W. Bush thought he needed to look tougher on immigration in order to create a deal in Congress, right, he started doing these dramatic workplace raids on places like Iowa, right?
Right, which were just terrible. Purposefully punitive.
Yes, right. And Obama has basically stop those, right?
Right.
You know, we do not see those kind of spectacular sort of punitive, as you say.
They're going in and they're just basically going to the companies and saying, prosecuting the owners of the companies instead of just showing up like Bush did and arresting everyone that shows up to work and terrorizing the community.
Right, or demanding that the owners basically fire everybody,
right,
rather than arrest them, right? So, I mean, but like I said, there's tons of wiggle room between the number of people that Obama's deporting now and zero. And there are numerous places along the line, I think, that Latino leaders and politicians would like him to be. But again, these are all just kind of, points along the spectrum. And I think, the bigger issue is they don't think he's done basically any of these things. And that he's, I don't want to overstate their estrangement from Obama too much, because as we saw just what happened in the midterms, Latinos voted overwhelmingly for Democrats, right? And the percentage hadn't particularly moved. But I think that's also a source of frustration, because I think if you talk to these leaders, they would say, well, there's nowhere for us to go. It's not like we're going to start voting for Republicans in massive numbers, because we don't think they share our goals either. So the only place for us to go is to do something. And in the article I write, that what Gutierrez compares it to really explicitly is the African American civil rights movement from the 1960s, which is just, again, just, you're not, it's not so much that you're causing a ruckus, though that's certainly part of it, but you're just not consulting with, the White House and Congress. You're just saying, look, if we want to stage a demonstration against deportations, we're not going to base that on getting the 60th vote in the Senate or what it's going to do politically. We're just going to stage a protest. If we want to have a massive march on Washington, we're not going to time it because there's legislation on the Hill or whatever, we're just going to do it and just have sort of more of an autonomous movement than certainly has been there before.
But let me ask you, what would make them happy? What would make that movement happy? Would I mean, because this, you know, we're talking about Reed's most recent Dream Act, but it's Dream Act version number 5 of just this year. So it's much more narrower than the first Dream Act.
Right.
Would any of those Dream Acts make the movement happy?
Certainly.
What are they looking for? I mean, you talked just now about a spectrum of, you know, immigration enforcement that the Obama administration can ease up on that would make them happier. So what do you think would really make them happy?
Well, I think, you know, when you talk, would they be happy with any of the various Dream Acts? Anything that that makes a number of citizens, you know, if we figure that we have a pool right now of about 11 million citizens in the United States who are, you know, illegal immigrants, undocumented immigrants, whatever you'd like to call them, anything that, you know, if you went to them and said, tomorrow we're going to pass a bill that makes 500,000 of these people or 800,000 of these people and potentially allows them to be citizens of the United States, they'd be happy with that. But you know, Gutierrez, when I was talking to him, compared it to opening the door. He says, you know, in fact, you know, we'd have to pass a law that would symbolically open the door for a whole day to get all 11 million immigrants in. What we're doing with the Dream Act is we're basically opening the door for an hour. But so, yes, they would be in favor of that. Yes, they'd be in favor of numerous, you know, versions of the Dream Act. But what they would also say is that, you know, our goal is to find a way to open that door for a whole day, to find a way to get all 11 million people into, you know, to find a way to.
I think that's, you know, a good analogy, because it's the fear that conservative has and why they're against the Dream Act is because, you know, they want to open it for an hour just for Dream Act, which leads to a day of the people here. But then you also have, you know, 7 million people just in Mexico alone who tell Gallup that they want to move to the United States. So then you got those 7 million there, let alone the rest of Latin America. So you quickly degenerate into a door open all the time, which is just politically untenable for a vast majority of the country.
Well, I mean, I would also say that one thing that's happened that we should share with context, because it applies not only to the frustration among certain leaders, but also to the argument of what you just said, is that in the last several years, a lot has happened in the United States in terms of border security, right? We've George W. Bush dramatically increased, and Clinton before him, if I'm not mistaken, dramatically increased the number of Border Patrol officers in the United States. We built, you know, hundreds of miles of wall on the Mexican border and all this stuff. And so I think when you talk to these leaders, what they're saying essentially is, look, we've done lots and lots of security procedures. You know, the border is... If the border isn't safer than it was, or I shouldn't say safer, but if it isn't less, if it's not harder to come into the United States illegally than it was 5 years ago and 10 years ago, well then we certainly spent a lot of money, we've thrown a lot of money toward that end.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
What they would say to you is that if you're going to go ahead and do these various provisions to allow people to become citizens, it's much harder to sneak in the United States. You're not going to have another massive. They would say another massive wave of immigration following right on the heels of it.
Yeah. Here's what I would say right back is, one, enforcement is a continuing battle. It can be easily stopped by any president. Guard troops can be recalled. Border control could be cut back. But more important, I think the focus on border patrol and a law is a bad focus. And that instead we should be focusing on interior enforcement and stopping the
interior
reason.
Enforcement.
Interior enforcement, not on the illegal aliens themselves, but the reasons why they are coming here, i.e., the better jobs that exist here than in the rest of the world. So, for example, you have Arizona, which passed E-Verify earlier this decade. And Arizona has seen a precipitous fall in its illegal immigration populations.
Right.
Don't tell
Jan Brewer.
Not just back to Mexico, but also to California and other states that don't have these employer regulations that make sure that they are following our immigration laws. And
right.
So I think there's a lot of progress that could be made on the enforcement front as far as E-Verify and other employer sanctions that would decrease the flow of legal immigrants into the country.
Right. Well, then the funny thing you say about that is that if Arizona's made progress on that, it certainly didn't come out in any of Jan Brewer's campaigns, right? You know, which presented Arizona as being under the attack, and I use that word purposely because that's sort of what she said, under attack from illegal immigrants, and not only that, but under attack anew from illegal immigrants, right? That were coming over as a result of drug war and stuff like that in Mexico. But, you know, I think that's an interesting point. What I would just say is that from this perspective, and this article is certainly just trying to figure out what the perspective is inside the community, is that they just feel they've had years and years of punitive measures, right? The wall to them was a punitive measure, which was, by the way, voted, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama both voted for the wall when they were in the Senate, the border fence when they were in the Senate. You know, they look at Arizona Senate Bill 1070. They look at, you know, the raid policy of the Bush administration. They look at the deportation policy of the Obama administration. They feel that they've had a string of punitive measures in a row, and they don't feel that they have gotten any sort of commensurate, you know, relief, right, even in something relatively modest on the scale of immigration reform like the DREAM Act. And so what they would say is that, look, we've endured years and years of these measures without any sort of end in sight, and when are the political winds going to shift the other way? And again, I'm just characterizing the feelings inside of me when I say that.
Right. I think one problem with that though is that they keep trying to fight back against the enforcement mechanism. So, for example, you know, everyone knows that the SB 1070 law was overturned by a judge, struck down by a federal judge in Arizona.
Right.
And that is, of course, working its way through the Ninth Circuit and will eventually be before the Supreme Court. But not as many people know that the Supreme Court is going to hear a case tomorrow, another immigration enforcement law from Arizona on the E-Verify law that I was just talking about.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
It's the same amnesty usual suspects that are the plaintiffs in that bill. It's, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, La Raza, SEIU, the same people that fight all enforcement mechanisms. And so if you look at, you know, for example, if you go back to the deal that Bush was fighting for at the close of his term in 2008, you know, he was promising all this internal enforcement like E-Verify. And a big reason why conservatives can never trust enforcement mechanisms is because the people that are advocating for a one-time amnesty that will then rely upon enforcement, then fight the very enforcement mechanisms like E-Verify.
Right. Well, I would think, I mean, to me, I when I look at E-Verify, I would say that, you know, if there were ever, and I don't see this happening anytime soon, but if there were ever a grand compromise on immigration, E-Verify would certainly be part of it, right? A national E-Verify law.
But see, that's just the problem, is that it would be part of the legislative compromise, but then the SEIU and the RAZA wouldn't be bound by that legislative compromise, and they'd fight it in the courts.
Yeah, but I mean, at the same time, you know, conservatives, you know, to say that conservatives would be somehow assuaged that once E-Verify was in practice, even a perfect E-Verify system, that they would say, oh, okay, well, then now we can move on and do other things. I mean, I would think that'd be pretty far-fetched too, don't you think?
Well, I think if you look at, would they all come in mass over? No, but if you're looking at picking off a couple already sympathetic Republicans, I think some actual good faith along that point would cause me to worry a lot more about losing enough Republicans to pass a broader immigration reform bill.
I mean, maybe so. I mean, one thing I'd just like to point out too that I find so interesting about this debate is the forces, and you called some of them the usual suspects, but on the forces on the side that favor some kind of massive reform are actually quite large now, right? And quite interesting and quite bipartisan, right? I mean, we just mentioned George W. Bush. And go ahead.
I was going to say those evil Chinese money-taking Chamber of Commerce is on the pro-immigration reform
The Chamber
side.
Of Commerce, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Mike Bloomberg, Rupert Murdoch, famously earlier this year, right, came out and said he supported some kind
right.
of immigration reform. The Southern Baptist Convention's political arm and Richard Land supports it. There's, you know, you could go, we just sort of keep going, right? I mean, Lindsey Graham, depending on the day of the week, supports it. There's actually a very, very large, in most, I think we could say fairly, most Democratic senators and most Democratic House members. So there's actually a very large coalition that supports it right now. But, you know, when we look at the political map, I would think neither one of us would think that it has any prayer of passing, certainly in the next 2 years.
No, no. So let's end on that known agreement and go to some really passionate disagreement.
Finally, some passionate, truly passionate.
Right,
passionate
it's about issue. Something that actually matters to real Americans, which is college football.
Well, I want to be very careful about saying real Americans in that in the tradition of Sarah Palin, but okay, yes, college. But I grant the point. A massive number of Americans, college football.
So you had another article, which, I found, intriguing, which was,
why do I think intriguing means you're about to disagree with it?
Meaning with you joining forces with Ari Fleischer, in
right.
support of the BCS.
Yes.
Defend yourself.
It was a marriage of convenience, as I think Ari would also say at the same time, but, Ari Fleischer, the former Bush administration spokesman, press secretary, of course, is one of about five people, I think, on Earth, including me, that is a passionate defender of the Bowl Championship Series, which is the current system under which college football selects its national champion. And I say five. I mean, I couldn't really quite name them off the top of my head, but I think when we talk about very small but very sort of dug in political coalitions, the pro BCS faction, us pro BCSers are definitely one of them.
Yes, and I'm with the raging hordes that think the BCS is evil incarnate. So let's go ahead. Let's just start with. I want you to defend this year's lineup of BCS games.
Sure.
Okay.
The first thing I'd say is that Oregon playing Auburn in the national championship game is a fantastic matchup.
I'll give you that one. I'm very excited about it. I can't wait to see it.
You're excited about it, right? But, again, if a playoff, it might not have happened. So I just want to know that the BCS did put together this game. And what I'd also note about the game that people tend to forget, because what they're arguing is playoff versus BCS, right, without any sort of sense of history. Under the old system, this matchup would never have happened. Oregon would have been contractually obligated to go to the Rose Bowl. Auburn would have been contractually obligated to go to the Sugar Bowl. We would have never seen this game at all.
True. Okay? True.
Fair enough.
Point for you.
The other thing I'd say is TCU, right? Now, when BCS critics always talk about the poor put-upon teams that aren't in the major conferences, TCU and Boise State, which in their minds get screwed because they don't have an equal chance to go to the national championship game as some of the big boys, right?
Uh-huh.
TCU, under this new system, is going to the Rose Bowl, right? Which would never have happened under the old system. I mean, the Rose Bowl wouldn't have taken a first, second, third, fourth look at TCU ever.
Right.
A small school like TCU, which if I'm remembering right, has 15,000-20,000 students, something like that, isn't going to bring a lot of traveling fans. So TCU has an undefeated season, and they get to go to the Rose Bowl. This would never have happened under the old system.
Okay, well, let me stop you right there, because the first item that you bring up with Ari Fleischer to defend the BCS is tradition, right? And could you tell me a little bit about the tradition of the Rose Bowl?
Right. Well, look, I mean, I'm not saying, obviously the BCS has, in some cases, change the traditions of college football. In this case, fundamentally change the Rose Bowl, which is Pac-10 versus Big Ten for years.
I'll go ahead and tell my cards. I'm a born up in the Bay Area. I'm a Cal Bears fan. There are a few things I like more than New Year's Day, Rose Bowl, Pac-10, Big Ten, Keith Jackson. That's heaven for me.
So you're kind of both a traditionalist and you want a massive change at the same time.
Yes, yes. And I have a plan, which we'll get to.
Wow. I would just say that certainly it has changed the nature of those games, but that for me it's a happy world when a team like TCU has a chance to go to a major game bowl game after a good year like this. The third and final thing I'll say,
I have no problem with TCU going to a major bowl game, just not the Rose Bowl.
So you'd be happy with them in the Fiesta Bowl or just somewhere else?
Yes.
Not in my backyard.
Not in my bowl game.
Okay, fair enough. The number three thing I'd say, and I'm reconsidering this point because I just found out you're a Cal Bears fan, is that Stanford, number two team, your mortal enemy.
Yes.
Number two in the Pac-10, but number one in most of America's hearts, is under the BCS system going to the Orange Bowl. And this is a case, again, under the old system, if you finish second in the Pac-10, you'd never have a chance to go to a major bowl game. But, and again, especially a school like Stanford, which is not going to bring a ton of alumni, is not going to, you know, be spending the bucks on football that some of the big state schools are doing. But in this case, the BCS puts Stanford, as a fantastic season with Andrew Luck, one loss, into the Orange Bowl. And that's certainly a major, to me, a major upside of the system, too. It's like, you,
well,
is, and this is, these rules have changed over the years. You know, they,
right.
They certainly tweaked the system to make it better.
Well, but, let's make this personal, okay?
Okay.
Because that same rule that allows the Orange Bowl to take Stanford.
Right.
I don't know if you remember this, but back in 2005, when USC went to the championship, the BCS championship game, that
right.
freed up the Rose Bowl to pick the number two Pac-10 team, which was the California Golden Bears, who haven't
oh,
been to
yes.
the Rose Bowl since the 40s. But who did they choose instead? They chose your
Texas Longhorns. Yes, they did.
So not only was that Rose Bowl denied a classic Pac-10, Big Ten matchup,
mm-hmm.
but it was your Texas Longhorns that came in and ruined my New Year's Day.
Right, and I do seem to remember a dramatic last-second field goal propelling the Longhorns to victory over the Michigan Wolverines. So, you know, I think you'd be in the minority of people who regret how actually the it was a pretty exciting game.
Okay.
You know, it was bad.
I've got another game for you to defend.
Okay.
Oklahoma versus Connecticut. 8-4, champions of the Big East, beaten by Temple, Connecticut.
I mean, so the thing about, am I tremendously excited for the Fiesta Bowl, especially since it involves Oklahoma? I would be lying if I said it did, right? Oklahoma, just the university doesn't do a ton for me normally, even on a good day. But the one thing I'd say about that is the system is not designed so that every bowl is fantastic, right? And the old system, you know, the matchups on a given year weren't fantastic either, right? I mean, we could go back and look at Fiesta Bowls from the beginning of time, and not every year is going to be a winner. And I do find it's a little weird that the Big East, you know, champion has to go to these things. And by the way, TCU is joining the Big East, right?
So maybe I am well aware.
So now TCU may fill this role. But look, it's not a fantastic game. To me, the happiest and biggest thing about the BCS, which was a dramatic improvement of the old system, is the fundamental part, right? It matches number one versus number two in the nation, which had this horrible habit of not happening under the old system.
Well, it hasn't always happened in the BCS system. You've had the LSU-USC year where both teams went undefeated and they were co-champions under the AP poll. So this has not been a perfect system. You still have undisputed, and it almost could have happened. I mean, if TCU beats Wisconsin, TCU has a very legitimate claim at the national title.
Right. I mean, though they won, I don't know about you, but I don't hear a ton of clamor that TCU deserves to be in the game this year. I just don't. I mean, I read, like I said, 99% of the
right,
I do
right. But you could
ball.
Let's say the Boise State kicker doesn't go wide left, right, and Boise State's
right.
undefeated. Boise State would be the only team that would be going to a bowl game that beat another BCS participant. They beat Virginia Tech in the beginning of the year. And so
mm-hmm.
you would have three undefeated teams, and Boise State would be left out.
Didn't Oregon beat BCS participant Stanford?
Well, automatic qualifier BCS. I mean, Virginia Tech won the ACC. Stanford didn't win the Pac-10.
Okay. But, you know, I think that, you know, I mean, to me, look, I mean, the big trade-off to me is that, for me, the trade-off I make when I say, you know, obviously the BCS system, if you have more than two undefeated teams, isn't going to be able to accommodate them, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what playoff advocates get most angry about. What I take as the trade-off is we have a fantastically interesting regular season in which you basically must be, if you want to have an automatic, you know, if you want to have a shot at the national championship game, you must be perfect, right? No other sport that I know of has a system where you literally cannot lose a game all year if you want to have the inside track to make it to the end. And what made the Boise so exciting this year is that every game is a cliffhanger, right? Boise had a relatively easy schedule. Nevada was one of their toughest games. And the fact that they were just – every game was a do or die for them made the season fantastically interesting. To me, that's the most – the thing I treasure most about college football is regular season, right? The postseason to me is – fun, exciting, and I was at the national championship game last year when Longhorns lost. Colt McCoy got hurt. not terribly excited. But I love the Bulls. I love all that kind of stuff. But to me, it's the regular season that's most exciting. The trade-off I'm willing to take is that there's a third or potentially fourth or last year even a fifth undefeated team that doesn't make it into the national championship game. But you have a regular season where every team is playing, has to win every single game. And that, to me, is the most exciting part about college football. That's just a trade-off I'm willing to make.
Okay, so let me go ahead and give you my pitch for my ideal selection. The other argument that I liked that you had was the playoff creep argument, which I will say is definitely a worry of mine.
Playoff creep?
Playoff creep, which is as soon as you have like four teams or eight teams, like the NFL and Major League Baseball and the NCAAs, it keeps widening the number of teams that qualify.
Do you see what happened to the NCAA basketball tournament this year?
Yes.
It's crazy, right? I mean, there aren't that many teams who deserve to be playing for the title, right?
Yeah.
I mean, even when I look at college football playoffs, to me, like, the absolute most of the year is, like, four, right? That you could say, well, these four teams deserve to be – four teams put up enough of a body of work to deserve to be national champions. There are not 16 teams in college football that deserve that honor. It's ridiculous.
I agree. I would not want to go to a bracket like NCAA football playoff system. So here's my hybrid solution.
Okay.
You keep the traditional bowls, right?
Yes.
And then you have the champions of each conference go to the bowl. So you'd have Pac-10 and Big Ten go to the Rose Bowl. You'd have ACC and Big 12 go to the Orange Bowl. You'd have the SEC and the Sugar Bowl, and you'd have whoever's left in the Fiesta Bowl.
Poor Fiesta Bowl.
Right. So then you'd have the winners of the four bowl games. They would play in two games the next week at the on the college campus of the teams with the highest rankings. And then you'd have a championship game the week after that. So we're only adding two more games. The regular season still matters because, Michigan, Ohio State, that still matters because you're fighting for the Big Ten championship. You know, the world's largest outdoor cocktail still matters because you're fighting for the SEC West. That way, everyone still has a chance to win, but you have to win your conference, and you get to keep not only the original bowls, but still, all the runners-up can still go to the Poulon Meat Eater Bowl if they want to.
Right. Thank you. Thank goodness. We wouldn't want to destroy that valuable tradition of college football that is the Poulon Meat Eater Bowl. I mean, to me, this sounds less bad than a lot of as a BCS proponent, this sounds a lot less bad than a lot of playoff proposals I've heard. But this is essentially an 8-team playoff, right?
It's essentially an 8-team playoff, yes.
Because the four bowls are essentially the first round of your playoff.
Right.
I mean, the only thing again that I would say to that is part of what I like about it is not just winning your conference, which is definitely important in college football, but under this system I could lose two games, I could lose a couple of non-conference games, I could blow one in conference and still be guaranteed a shot as long as I win the SEC to get into this national championship tournament.
Although you chose a bad example there because most SEC teams could blow a couple non-conference games and still have a shot at the national championship. Big Ten, no. Pac-10, no. But SEC.
Oh, right.
Still have a shot.
Okay. Well, so, yeah. But agree. But what I like is the kind of play between conferences where I not only have to dominate my conference to be the champion, I have to win every single game. I can't go, I can't go 11-1.
Right, but then but then you get ridiculousness like the Ohio State schedule, who has, eight home games every year, and three of them are cupcakes. You get Florida beating up on Troy at the end of the year.
Florida didn't, but these teams did, done it. Florida hasn't gone undefeated under Urban Meyer ever. So somehow that doesn't happen, right? And Jim Tressel's only managed it once at Ohio State, when he upset Miami in the national championship game. So I don't know that just happens actually so much, People say, these teams are just going to skate through and everybody's going to be undefeated, but it doesn't actually happen that often.
Well,
it's hard. It's really hard.
I think you'd see better non-conference matchups if teams didn't have to go undefeated. You wouldn't get all these cupcakes early and late in the season if teams could, lose a game and still win their conference.
I would like to see potentially some mechanism that has some control over who teams play in non-conference. And I know you've been there too, but having sat through in my life a million and a half directional Louisiana schools in August and Rice and everybody else. I mean, it's just after a while, it's like, oh, please make it stop.
Right.
Make it be a game
right.
I actually
right.
care about. So I got
a partial sign on for my plan here.
Yeah, I would say that it's, you know, I'll vote for an enclosure, but I'm not going to, it's probably still a no when it comes to the up or down vote in the Senate.
Okay, I will hold this against you. The rest, the Dream Act, taxes I can forgive, but I don't know, BCS support, that might be a non-starter.
We'll have to agree to disagree.
Okay, we're pushing up on 50 minutes. Do you want to talk about goatees or save that for another time?
Why don't we save it for another? Why don't we declare victory here? Why don't we declare an elegant end of season BCS style victory and save that for the next time?
Okay, hold on. One last thing. Auburn, Oregon. Who you got?
I don't know if it's my the SEC bias that the world has pounded into me over the last 6 years, but I sort of like Auburn.
Okay. Are you in DC?
I'm in New York.
You're in New York. Do you come to DC?
I come to D.C. once in a while.
Would you be willing to bet dinner on the national championship game?
Absolutely. You stick with your Pac-10 roots.
I'm a believer in Oregon.
Fantastic. It's a dinner then, and it's on tape.
Okay, there you go. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Con, and thanks so much. This has been really fun.
It was.
Take care.